Chris Graham, the president of More Beer, is my guest this week. He's here to discuss kegging your homebrewed beer. This is Beersmith Podcast number 206.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Today on the show, I welcome back Chris Graham. Chris is president of More Beer and has been in brewing for over 19 years. Chris taught at the Seibel Institute and was also a former board member on the Brewers Association Board of Directors and the American Homebrewers Association Governing Council. Chris, it's great to have you back. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
How are things up there in Northern California this week?
You know, we're good and rainy, and it's the holiday season here, so things are going well.
Well, what's going on at More Beer? I think you guys are still growing, right?
Still growing. It's a little bit tougher of an environment out there, but tons of new products that are really leading the way for growth. A lot of glycol systems, bigger fermenters, all-in-one brew systems. You can buy about 20 different versions now.
Pretty amazing. I was using a plastic bucket for forever, but now you can get all kinds of stuff, huh?
Exactly.
Well, Chris, a couple of years back, we did a segment on kegging, which was excellent. But today we're going to try and bring people up to date. Before we do, can you talk over maybe some of the advantages of kegging versus bottling?
You know, it's the reason I got into it was I loved the fact that it was just one thing to clean up, one thing to set up. Everyone hates cleaning. I mean, let's just face it.
I hate cleaning.
If you like cleaning, you might want to get tested. So I used to clean 48 some odd bottles for every batch I was going to bottle up. And then I thought, wow, I only have to clean one keg when I do this. Now, cleaning one keg is a little bit more work, but it's just one thing. And that was my lead into the whole thing. But then once I got into kegging, I realized like, oh, this is awesome for pinpointing the carbonation level I want the beer to be at. It's great for parties. I also love it because I can try beers more often, earlier, you know, and I can pour as little as I want. So don't have to open a whole 12 or 22 ounce bottle, especially when the beer is maturing. And let's not discount the fact that it's just really cool. People come to your house, cool. They see beer on draft, they love that.
It is very cool, and you can take it. You can take it to parties too.
Exactly, especially with the onset of the smaller kegs have become really popular now, and or filling a growler off your keg. But yes, quite portable now.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the basic components of a keg system. What do you have to do to get started?
You're going to need, kind of your main things, your CO2 tank and regulator. Those are, you could buy those used, you can get them new. The new prices have come down so far from when I first started doing this that it really doesn't matter which way you go, but it used to be that used was the way to go. But your CO2 tank and regulator is your key to the whole thing. Then you need an actual keg. And in the world of kegs, you kind of have your ball lock keg, your pinlock keg, and your Sankey keg. Let's take away Sankey keg. That takes a very unique coupler, a unique tap to open it. Think of
well, just so folks know, though, the Sankey keg is what you would typically get if you bought commercial beer in most cases, right?
Exactly. The Bud Miller Coors and most craft breweries, to be honest, come in Sankey keg. It's a single piece that you twist onto the keg and then engage to serve out of it. But it's very hard to clean. So most of those breweries have proper equipment to clean them that we don't have at home. So we use the Pepsi and Coke kegs. The Pepsi used ball lock, the Coke used pinlock, and that's kind of the popularity of them. The ball lock uses a quick disconnect that you pull a sleeve up that disengages the balls, allows you to push it on the post. There's a picture of one. Whereas the pinlock, you have two or three posts depending on beer or gas, coming off of the fitting, and you twist to lock down your quick disconnect on there. Either one is just fine. In fact, some of us have both inside of our breweries, our home breweries. I will use them to differentiate between soda and beer, or sometimes a sour or something that I just don't want to mix in general population of my beer kegs. It's nice to have that other kind, because then you can never accidentally cross post on them.
So so that determines your keg system. I think the ball's a little more popular. Is that right?
I would say the ball lock in terms of home brewing is the most popular, but I see quite a few pin locks out there. I think it's where you are in the country to what was the most popular around you. So once you have your ball lock or pin lock keg, doesn't matter each way, but the nice thing about a keg is it has generally a nice large opening that you can open up. If you're buying used, you're going to want to replace those O-rings. The beauty is new kegs are almost as inexpensive now as used ones are, because used ones are getting harder to find.
Yeah, I mean, we switched over, the soda system switched over, I think, in the early 90s, something like that, right?
Exactly.
And then for a long time, there was like a billion used kegs around, which is why we used to pick them up so cheap. But I think I got some for under $20 at one time.
I think I bought a whole container at like $2.50 a keg at one point.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and now, now we're buying kegs at, not the same price as new, but fairly close to it. But long story short, if you get a used one, you're going to want to replace those O-rings, both on the lid of the keg, as well as the body connects and the dip tube connects, because those O-rings will keep that sugary smells and such from what was in them before. But then on a new keg, same thing. The O-ring's already new, so you can open it, clean it easily. I highly recommend getting a line brush to clean the beverage dip tube, and then seal it all back up, sanitize it, put it all back together, sanitize it, empty it, and then you're ready to fill it. Once you fill it, then you got to store it cold. So when you're going to get into kegging, you're going to want a refrigeration of some sort.
And I do want to get into that, but let's step back for just a second and walk through the components again so folks understand. I'll put up the picture here, but
cool.
So first of all, you got to have a CO2 source, right?
CO2 tank and a regulator. And most of the time when you get a CO2 tank, it's going to be empty if you buy it online.
So or a picture here, you see the CO2 tanks, the one on the left there, I guess.
Correct. It's the left. It usually has the black handle on top to open it up.
So it looks like a mini oxygen tank or something like that.
Exactly. And so those you're typically going to do one of two things with. You're going to take it to a gas place and you're going to either swap it, where you might bring them in this beautiful, shiny aluminum tank and they give you back this beat up steel, rusty looking thing.
That's what usually happens when I go.
At first I used to get majorly offended by that. And now I realized I don't care. I'm going to get a new one the next time I go and just swap. And most of the time they're not actually visible to anyone, but it's frustrating. And if you could find a place that will still fill CO2 on demand, those are awesome. But I feel like they're increasingly more rare and rare when it comes to working with air gas or whatnot. If you're lucky enough to have a local homebrew shop, check in with them, because they hopefully will work with a gas place to get ones filled and be able to do the swaps for you.
Okay, so then on top of that, you put a regulator, which in the picture here, a little red handle on it, I guess, with the two dials. And talk about one versus two dials.
So you need one dial at minimum. The top dial in your photo is the pressure you're going into the keg with. So the top dial's in line with the exit of the gas. And on the bottom of the regulator is usually a little shutoff switch that you could turn it on and off. So you're going to hook your regulator onto the tank, tighten it up. Usually it comes with a one-time use O-ring or gasket that mm-hmm. will mold itself to the opening to prevent leaks. Tighten that on, snug it on, and then you're going to turn that red plastic piece, that one particularly is a hand turn knob. Some require a screwdriver. Some have little lockouts, but they all work the same way. If you turn them to the right, you will increase the pressure that you're letting go through the system into the lines, into the keg. So that one measures the PSI of the gas going out of the regulator and into your system.
Right. And so, I mean, I can't remember the air in the compressed tank is like 800 PSI or something like that. And when it,
depends
when it comes
if
out,
you store it warm or cold.
Yeah, when it comes out, we want it much lower, 15, 10, 12, something like that, right?
Exactly. And I think we'll get into a little bit of carbonating here in a bit. But yes, there's definitely standards that you're going to do. And then the other regulator, some regulators have them, some don't. But all they're doing is telling you, do you have what pressure is coming out of your tank? The hard part about most of those regulators are CO2 is a liquid, so it puts off a gas. And through most of the depletion of that liquid, the gas head pressure remains relatively the same. Right. You don't really see it move until you start getting maybe like to the point where you have one third left.
So realistically, at least my experience is when the keg, you don't find the kegs empty until it's empty, right?
Exactly.
The gas tank, I should say.
Yeah. So if you're going to have a party, one of the things I always recommend doing is look on the side of your tank. It should have a TW number, a tare weight number. And that number is how much that tank weighs empty. So then you can quickly measure, you know, okay, let's say that weighs 12 pounds and I put the whole thing on the scale, it weighs 15. Okay, I have my 3 pounds of gas in there. So what I've done is I also measure my regulator too, the weight of it. So I don't have to take the regulator off the tank to give it a quick weigh to know how much gas I have left in that CO2 tank system.
Right. Okay, so that then goes into the input side of the keg, right?
Yep. And so your quick disconnect that comes off of that is typically gray. And we always think of gray for gas because you really, especially on a ball lock, a pin lock is beautiful in that you can't accidentally put the gas post on the liquid post because one has two pins, one has three pins. But on the ball lock side, there are just millimeters of diameter difference. And
they are different sizes, right?
They are. And one you can get on the other because one's bigger than the other, but getting it off of the other sometimes requires a Sawzall or whatnot. So you really want to pay attention. On the quick disconnect is usually gray, sometimes white, but gray or a color with a gray cap. And then the post on the keg typically has a what I call a pneumatic strike on the part that you put the wrench to tighten the bolt on. So, you know, the pneumatic little line shows you that, hey, this is a gas side as opposed to the other quick disconnect typically won't have that where you put the wrench on to tighten it. And that's how you know which one goes on the gas and which one goes on the beer.
And then on the other side, of course, you hook up your tap line, right?
The best side, the output, the beer line.
In this case, black. I think we're looking at a picnic tap here, right?
So coming off the keg, you have the black QD. And so we talked about a gray QD for gas and a black QD for beer. It's the way we like to describe it to people. Going to a basic flexible line tube that goes, in this scenario, to a picnic tap. Some people call them a Cobra tap, picnic tap, but just one that you squeeze a little nozzle and beer comes out.
So that would be a great one for parties, right?
I don't think anyone should be without one of those. I use it for sample taking in my fridges. You can move them quickly and easily. You can clean them fairly easily. They're convenient. And they almost always come with your first kit. And then depending on how you want to serve later on, you can replace that with something more fancy.
And of course, you walked us through the basic kegging process, but you clean, sanitize the thing, right? And then you transfer, usually siphon your beer into the keg. And then it's a matter of pressurizing it, right?
Exactly. And we, you know, anyone who's just getting into this, I highly recommend after you listen to this podcast, you go back and listen to our original one because we really get in depth on it. Yeah. But you fill it, then you got to chill it. That's the key to carbonation.
Right. So let's walk through the chilling options now. Obviously, you need some kind of refrigerator in order to get proper pressure, right?
Exactly. So we're going to use, to carbonate in a keg, we're going to use a carbonation chart. And that's going to tell you the temperature, which is what we'll focus on now, and the CO2 level, which we talked about, which was dialing our CO2 regulator. And, you know, most of the time people have styles that they're going to for, and then it'll tell them the volumes of CO2 they're trying to achieve. You then say, oh, I keep my kegerator at this temperature, so thusly I need this pressure to get that volumes. So, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I went to a party and there was a keg and there was a bucket of ice and it was perfect. I served my Budweiser or craft beer and it worked out great for that 4-hour party. And that is great for a 4-hour party, but you really wouldn't want to use a bucket of ice unless you maybe lived in Alaska or somewhere where ice is readily available all the time to run your kegerator. So most of us start cheap. I'm a fairly cheap person.
What are the options for a keg system, for a refrigerator, I should say?
Any old fridge is a great starting point. I can't think of too many homebrewers who didn't take somebody's old fridge, whether it was their own and they got a new one, or they bought one on Craigslist or whatever, and they said, okay, I'm going to turn this into my kegerator. And, you know, they're kind of obnoxious. I'm talking about the standard upright style with either a front, you know, two double door or a single door freezer on top, either way. And the reason I say they're fairly obnoxious is the bottom isn't typically flat. So you usually have to build your own system at the bottom to support the weight of the keg. And often I put my CO2 tank and regulator right in the refrigerator. And in a scenario like that, I'm probably going to have two or three kegs in there instead of just one. So I'm usually using a plywood or something strong enough and then supporting that, either building a wooden base that can handle that compressor angle or cinder blocks in the front and maybe something in the back to kind of help support the weight. But that's probably your most basic way to do it. And most refrigerators have the right temperature, so you don't even truly for serving need an external temp controller.
Yeah, I think most of kegs run around, I don't know, around 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 5 degrees C, maybe something like that.
Totally fine. Anywhere from, I just tell people, don't go close to freezing, because when you go close to freezing, that means you go under freezing and then over freezing and under freezing and over freezing, and where the liquid gets thin, meaning the tubing, the quick disconnects, you can run the risk of freezing, and then that's a royal pain. So 35 to 40, 42, those are all fine temperatures as long as it's relatively consistent.
And of course, there's other options too, the infamous Keezer and kegerators, right?
Of course, there's the young man's game called the chest freezer. And I say that as I'm no longer the young man anymore, because now you're lifting a 5-gallon keg up and over the height of a kegerator to put it down into the chest freezer.
And it's hard to do from your walker, right, Chris?
It's not that. It's just, you know, those things are usually 36 inches high or 32 inches high, and I'm lifting it over there, and that's not so fun anymore. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know a lot of people who built block and chain pulley systems to put their kegs into their kegerators now.
Now, if you go to a freezer, you do need a temperature controller of some kind, right?
I was just about to say that. Oh, sorry. Oftentimes, you're going to need a temp controller, and they're cheap. You can do them, you know, high 20s, and the really, really good ones, the ones that are like bulletproof, are maybe up to 100. And those are like the Johnson ones with the bulb. They're not digital. They're analog, and they're just, I call them bulletproof because I've had ones for close to 20 years now that have gotten ran over by my kids' bikes, smashed in the door repeatedly where the line goes through, and the things just keep working. And there's a bunch of choices in between, but essentially those, you plug those into the wall, then you plug the chest freezer into it, and it's regulating when it gets, and then the temp sensor into the kegerator, and then it's now telling your refrigerator when it's going to get power or not.
It turns the freezer on and off, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So the other thing that often has to be done in a chest freezer is they're oftentimes not quite tall enough to serve out of. with a corny keg. So oftentimes people will build a collar just out of 2x4s, 2x6s, 2x8s even. There's a ton of how-tos online where they'll just build that up. And the other advantage to do that is then people will put a shank through them for a faucet to serve out of. So there's two ways you could serve out of, or three ways you could serve out of a chest freezer. You can either open the door every single time and have our little picnic tap inside, serve yourself a beer and be done. Or you can have, like I said, a collar that goes up. Then you drill hole, 1-inch holes, put a shank through, put and have your faucet on the outside, which looks like your average bar where the where the cold box is right there where they're serving beer. So it looks like beer shanks are just coming from the wall as opposed to the top. Or you can put a tower on top of them. Now, keep in mind, most chest freezers have a really flimsy lid. So you'll have to reinforce that lid before you put the tower on top. But those can look really classy and really nice and be a nice presentation style.
And of course, you can put taps on your regular fridge as well, right?
Get oh, of the course. Right place, we skip that part. Yeah. So a regular fridge, the typical route for most of us is to just run a holes through the front door and put shanks for that. And the nice thing about fridges nowadays is they most of the time don't have Freon running through the front door. They'll maybe super old school ones might have that. That's probably rare. But the sides, you have to be a little bit careful if you're going to drill your holes through the sides that you could accidentally puncture your Freon lines, in which case that fridge is probably toast. Probably not worth fixing.
And then, of course, the last option is a kegerator, right?
Exactly. And it used to be, oh God, you know, I remember I bought a kegerator off of the equivalent of Craigslist at the time. It was probably Yahoo or something, but I bought one used and it was really cool looking. And this thing was probably like 30 years in a bar, in an Irish bar, barely cleaned. But it was great. I think it was a brand name True, and the thing ran. I mean, it felt like it was sucking all the power out of your house when it ran, but it was true commercial refrigeration. And I remember looking one up new, just like, oh, how much to replace it with a new model? And I think it was $2,500 at the time. And I'm like, oh, wow. You know, the $150 I paid for it wasn't so bad. Yeah. But nowadays, you see them out there all the time for $500, $600, up to $800 or $900 with stainless steel tops and two or three faucets. And they're almost purpose-built for homebrewing now, where that was definitely not the case in the past.
Yeah, I've got one that holds three kegs, and it's got a nice tower on top. Looks beautiful, you know.
Yeah, we sell a lot of those, and in fact, we're working with someone right now, and we're working on a one that'll hold four as well at that price point of a three, which is kind of cool. You have to put the CO2 tank on the outside and the back, but he puts a hanger basket for it and a line system to get the CO2 on the inside.
Nice. Well, let's talk about actually pressuring it. So you know, if you run it at 40 degrees or about 5 degrees C, what kind of pressure do you typically run your system at?
I'm usually running roughly 12 PSI. I've gotten lazy over the years.
Yeah, I think that's pretty close to what I do too. Just set it at 12 and let it go.
I used to be very into each beer, its own style, its own CO2 level, all of that. And I've kind of found that 12-ish PSI kind of works for most things. Maybe a Berliner Weiss I want to take up higher. And maybe a certain stout or so, I might want to go a little bit lower. But for the most part, that's my sweet spot. And what's nice about that is then you can have one regulator kind of serving everything. So most of us, when we have a kegerator set up, we're not doing one keg after a bit. We're doing three, maybe four, like you talked about. You have three in your kegerator. Yeah. Well, it's nice when you can have one pressure that runs all of them. There are ways of stepping down the pressure. There's secondary regulators. There's even inline line regulators now that you could put in there. But what's nice about that 12 PSI is it's kind of it's workable for most other beers.
And of course that works with relatively short keg lines. I think most of the keg lines are like 4 or 5 feet. What do you do if you got to run a longer line? You have to start worrying about this thing called keg line balancing, right?
Yes. And, you know, most of the time, and, you know, the theory behind keg line balancing, or at least the math, has changed as all the polymers have changed. And now it's really hard to find a perfect chart that works for everything. Used to be that I always used about a 2.1 or 2 pounds of restriction per one linear foot.
Yeah, the issue here is that the it loses pressure the longer the keg line gets, right? And ideally, you want to balance it so it's kind of close to zero when it's at the tap, right?
It's like a net neutral when it's coming out. It's just flowing perfect. But yeah, so you might have to experiment a little bit. But what I'm finding is the slicker the line, the harder the tubing, the longer the line, the more flexible, the more porous, the shorter the line. And I say shorter. We're not talking like 1 foot versus 10. We're talking 6 versus 4.5.
Right. But if you have a really long set of keg lines, you then need to balance that out so that you get the right keg line material, or perhaps run your system at a higher pressure, right?
I was going to say, the long line systems to me for the home use is one of the more difficult things to do. So if you want to have one where you're having what I call a remote faucet from where your kegs are, you should actually talk to your local homebrew store for tips and tricks before you do it. But essentially, the other thing that can happen is with those types of systems, one, you have the length, so you have your restrictions per foot. So you're going to typically use a bigger diameter tubing to give less restriction so that you don't overcarbonate your beer in order to serve it that distance. But the other thing is temperature. Temperature is kind of key in the serve. And it's one of these tough things. And a great analogy of this is a very good friend of mine's family moved from across the way here in California from me to Las Vegas for a job opportunity. And his wife bought him a kegerator as kind of his birthday present or Father's Day. I can't remember what. And, you know, he had it here in California, Northern California, outside for 3 or 4 months, and beer poured perfectly. Then he calls me in his first weekend in Vegas saying, what's going wrong? And it's 115 outside. And while the beer is still holding like 40 something degrees, the faucet that the beer was coming out was blazing hot. And what would happen is he would try to fill a pitcher, and in the beginning it's all foam, and as the beer cooled the faucet down, it poured a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better. So he was wasting 2 or 3 pitchers of beer trying to get one pint of beer served, and I convinced him to just put the kegerator into his garage, and at least helped quite a bit.
Even my kegerator, the tower is not really chilled, so you know, a lot of times I'll pour off that little bit of stuff on the top first before I start drinking the beer, you know.
Yep. Yeah, and we sell a little fan kit you can add in if you want.
I've seen those.
To help. It doesn't do a ton unless it's running all the time. You can't like turn it on for 5 minutes and expect it to cool it down. But what they do at a bar scenario is they have a glycol system that is running, and usually that's doing multiple purposes, but one of them in a long line system is one of the line runs to the faucets is glycol. Then they have metal loops behind all the faucets keeping that cool, and then a return line back to the glycol. So they're running this super cooled liquid to help keep the equipment cold.
Right. Okay, well, I don't want to spend too much more time on the basic kegging stuff. We did cover it quite a bit in the last episode, so folks that are listening, I encourage you to dive into that. But I did want to cover some of the new aids available. Why don't we start with the floating dip tube, which I hadn't seen.
Yeah, the buoy. That thing is highly, highly popular. So if you click onto one of the other pictures of it, we can see that's kind of a cutout of how it goes. And you can, if you click on the picture, you can see it a little closer, but there you go. That's perfect. So you replace your gas or your beverage dip tube with a shorty dip tube.
So the dip tube is originally, it's just this long thing that goes to the bottom so that it pulls the beer off the bottom of the keg, right?
Exactly. It's just a stainless tube. Sometimes they're bent a little bit, but they take it from the quick disconnect at the top all the way to the bottom. So you're drawing off the bottom.
And this, of course, scenario, there's a problem to that, right?
Well, most of us who dry hop learn usually pretty early that if we're not really good about keeping everything out of the beer, we clog things up, and that's a bit of a nightmare.
Right, because all the sediment ends up on the bottom of the beer as well, or bottom of the keg as well. So it's the first thing that gets sucked up by the tube.
Exactly. And if it's just a little bit of troop, that's usually never a problem. I mean, I don't think I've ever stuck a keg that I hadn't dry hopped or put an addition of something into the keg that physically clogged that dip tube up. But your typical troop and you know, yeast and such isn't going to clog that tube unless you really carried a lot through. But in the onset of hazies, West Coast IPAs, East Coast IPAs, all of these things where we're adding just boatloads of hops, sometimes to the keg, or we're accidentally getting a lot from our fermenter to the keg, that's where things can really go wrong. And once that thing gets clogged, it's really hard to sanitarily unclog it.
So you've got a new product that has a floating dip tube that picks it up from the top, not the bottom, I think, right?
Exactly. So benefit number one, prevents clogging. Benefit number two is most of the time when you get a keg, you let the beer carbonate, mature in there. We talked about our pressure, 12 PSI. I'm usually letting that just sit for a week. Usually after a week, I've hit my optimal saturation level and it's ready to serve. Right. Well, what also happens in that week is most of the yeast flocculates out, settles to the bottom, and you just get a fine layer of trub and yeast. Well, keg bottoms aren't flat. So if you have a traditional dip tube, most of that just gets sucked up in those first few pours. And it's never perfect. It's never like, oh, I got all of it out in one glass. It's like the first 10 pints have some of that sediment going through.
It looked like a Hefeweizen, huh?
Exactly. But it's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be a Helles, or it's supposed to be a Pilsner, and it's all cloudy. So the beauty of the floating ball is the intake will actually float below the ball typically, because you can see it in that picture demonstrated well, because the ball will be floating all the way up and then that'll hang down off of it. So you're actually pulling from maybe 2 inches underneath the top of the liquid level. So while as you're pulling your beers out, you're getting about the clearest part of your beer the entire way down. And then when you get all the way to the bottom, if you didn't have much at all, it'll lay all the way, usually all the way on the bottom, so you can maximize everything you're getting out of there. But if you have a lot of sediment, you can stop pouring when it does get a little bit obnoxious.
Nice. Well, some people are also starting to do pressurized keg transfers and also pressurized fermentation for lagers. If you do that, you can actually reduce the ester level. Tell us a little bit about those, and I've got a couple more pictures here I'll pull up.
Cool. Well, the onset of the inexpensive spunding valve has helped this quite a bit. Basically, a valve that allows you to release gas, but at a set pressure, and really be able to control it well. So on this, on the left side of that picture, is a threaded piece that has a spring inside of it that's pushing a diaphragm against a wall. And the tension, and as you turn it, you're changing the tension that it's pushing on that spring to be able to set it for, let's say, like you said, a lager fermentation. You could do it right there in the corny keg, but now there's a ton of pressurized fermenters out there from the ranges of $125 up to, you know, I'm sure they go up to the thousands, but in the 125 to 500 range, there's a few of them that allow this to be something more of us can do at an affordable price.
So if you got a pressure capable fermenter, you can ferment at a higher pressure. You can also do what's called pressurized transfers. Can you talk about that?
Exactly. So you can also, instead of gravity feeding or even worse, siphoning, you can now just add a light blanket of CO2, a light pressure of CO2 onto your fermenter to push it out in a closed system to your keg or whatever, a bright tank if you want, but most of us have kegs, without exposing it to ambient air. So you really cut down on the oxidization of that beer, which is one of the things in homebrewing that typically has a huge impact on the flavor of our beer.
Right. Typically, when we do a transfer, we're risking introducing oxygen into it, particularly if you're siphoning.
Exactly.
But if you do one of these closed system transfers, I assume you put a little bit of CO2 in the keg too. And so you got CO2 blanketing everything, right?
Exactly. And when I do it, I will pre-fill my keg with Star Sand or whatever I'm sanitizing with. And then I will actually push that out with CO2. So now I'm full. I have zero oxygen in that keg. And then I'm filling it closed with a spunding valve on the other direction, allowing, you know, the liquid level to fill, but keeping it sealed off to ambient air getting back into it.
So you basically got an entirely closed system and no oxygen.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice. Let's see. We talked about the surplus soda kegs being harder and harder to find. And you got a lot of new kegs now. And I didn't know you actually have larger size kegs available now.
Yeah, we just started carrying them. Our torpedo kegs have been super popular the last couple of years. And the reason those got popular was one, all metal design, which was cool, and they stack. And then we were kicking around an idea of, you know, why is it that we always cap kegs? We only have kegs from 1 gallon up to 5 gallons. Wouldn't it be cool to have one for those of us brewing bigger batches to do a 10 gallon or even a 15. So we talked to a few manufacturers about it, and we were able to do the larger size, and they're selling quite well. And I think the 10's the sweet spot. You know,
yeah,
you
I was going to say a 15 gallon keg's got to be over 100 pounds, right?
Exactly. In a 10 gallon keg, you have, if you filled it to 10, you have 80 gallons or 80 pounds ish of beer. So you can lift that. Even old man Graham can lift that. I probably couldn't lift it into
40 kilograms for those listening, right?
Yeah, I couldn't lift that over a Keyser wall, but I could at least get it up into my regular refrigerator.
So you have the 10 gallon size, which is I don't know, is that about the size of a pony keg? I'm trying to say it's a quarter keg, right?
It is. It's roughly the same diameter and just shorter. The dimensions are near the bottom, and then the 15.5, which is the same size as your Bud Miller Coors style keg.
So yeah, 15 gallon keg, that's got to be pretty heavy.
It is. That's a two-man lift, as we like to call it.
Yeah. So there's a 15-gallon keg, torpedo kegs. So yeah. So now you have those options, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and it's fun. As a home brewer now, you can get a 1 gallon keg, a 2.5 gallon keg, and split your batch into two batches, or you can bottle half and keg half and take it to a party. The 1 gallon sizes have become one of my favorites because I'll do, you know, a big beer into them, a barley wine or something like that, where you're not going through much. Or I will actually serve cocktails out of them as well.
Yeah, look, there's some of the smaller ones there, the slim line, I guess.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. Yeah, I've got a couple of small ones now, too, and they're great because the nice thing is when a keg gets part empty, you can empty it into a different keg.
Exactly. Transfer. The other thing is that, so we'll have our company Christmas party, and we'll usually get some pretty good kegs of beer for it. And at the end of the night, and we've served with CO2 out of a jockey box, at the end of the night, we might have, you know, out of a 15.5 of Pliny, we might have 5-6 gallons left, and it's great. We'll transfer them into these and split them up, and you know, 5 or 6 of us take 1 gallon home, or into 2.5s or whatnot.
And another product you mentioned is you've got these new duo-tight connections, I guess. Now, does that help reduce some of these gas leak problems and keg leak problems?
I'll tell you what. If anything, it's helped me reduce the amount of scrapes, bumps and bruises on my knuckles than anything else. So forever, I've always used soft flexible tubing that you put over a barb, and then you put a hose clamp on the outside. And usually those hose clamps are the type that you use a screwdriver that never quite fit into them properly, and I can never find a nut driver the right size. So then I slip off and slice my hand. So anyway, and the problem with a lot of times when you have one diameter inner diameter tubing, you have a barb that's a different diameter and a hose clamp clamping down, it just really is tough to keep sanitary as well as sealed. So especially on the gas side, keeping it leak free is.
Yeah, I often find I get gas leaks, and even when I test for it, it's hard to find them all.
Yeah, and actually, you'll test at room temperature, put them in the fridge, and then everything changes a little bit because it's cold, yeah. And then you end up with a leak you didn't even know you had. So these duo-tight fittings are Very similar to the traditional John Guest fitting, which has been around for years in all kinds of industries. But the idea is you use a rigid style tubing as opposed to the flexible style tubing. And you got to buy, the key thing is you buy the right diameters to match up with each other. We only sell two different diameters to keep it kind of simple. But you just slide the line in, pull on it, and it just locks into place. The Duotite, the guys who made this, they ended up using two O-rings, and they made it specifically for the draft industry to get a better seal. And the second O-ring allows, even when you didn't quite get it in all the way right, it helps keep that seal a little bit better and that alignment better. But they're cool because when you want to take them off, all you have to do is lift the collar, and then they slide right out again. So they're reusable, they're fast to change over. In fact, personally, sometimes I end up with Sankey kegs from friends who own breweries and Corny. And I used to have all kinds of elaborate fittings to switch between the two of them. And now I just take my beer and gas line, and both they make duo tights that'll go onto a Sankey tap, and they make one that'll thread onto a quick disconnect with flare threads. So I can change between Sankey and homebrew line within milliseconds. And I haven't had a gas leak since.
So they're not flexible though. So that's one disadvantage, right? You probably use them on the gas side, I would guess.
I use them on both now. The tubing isn't as flexible. It's plenty flexible. I can open the refrigerator door and the line will flex with that and such. The radius isn't going to be, you know, a tight loop. It's going to be more of an arc. And if you've ever seen a long line system where they have what's called a trunk line, where they wrap a bunch of insulation around 5 or 6 or 10 beer lines that are kind of hard plastic, it's that type of material. Right. So the tubing we sell is called EVA Barrier, and it's kind of the best of all worlds. It's got a little bit of bend, but it also has a lot of great oxygen barrier qualities to it as well.
Nice. Well, I also get the question quite often about kegging mead and wine, which you can do at low pressure. How do you do that?
My biggest recommendation is to go argon. Argon's a pretty common gas. It's finding it in small tanks. Now, some places will fill argon into a CO2 tank. Some places will fill it into a nitrogen tank. So you really want to, if you're going to do that, I would probably start with where you can get gas and talk to them first. You can do an alley gas, a blend of 70-30, 75-25 CO2
nitrogen. Can you talk for a minute about why CO2, pure CO2, is probably not a great option for mead and wine?
Well, CO2, and it can be, it can be interesting, but CO2 will absorb into most liquids, so you will get that carbonic acid effect. Sparkling water, any kind of carbonated water where you get that little bit of bite, well, that gets accentuated in a wine. I don't think that would be very
good. Well, most wines actually have some CO2 in them, but you don't really want to upset that balance, I think, right?
Exactly. You don't want to make it even farther on the CO2 side. And then meads, if you want to keep that nice balance of sweetness and taste the honey and all of that, you want an inert gas, and that's probably where I should have started, where you'd rather have a nitrogen or argon gas, which is typically just going to push down on the liquid, not be absorbed by the liquid. My personal preference is argon, but nitrogen will work just fine for this. And just like the CO2 tank and regulator we looked at earlier, they sell home-based tanks and regulators. The hard part about nitrogen is it's a gas that never goes into a liquid form at most temperatures. So when you buy your bottle or your bottle of gas, they sell it in like the cubic foot because they're just compressing it as compressed as they can get it. So one tank of argon or of nitrogen, only pushes us 2.5-5 gallon kegs or so, whereas a CO2 tank is a liquid inside of there. So you'll, probably 10 to 12 Corny kegs worth of beer coming out.
Now, I actually researched this a while back. I know a lot of commercial wine systems actually use a CO2 nitrogen mix. And what they do is they actually adjust it. They actually have a mixer, and they adjust that mix to match the wine that they're using and the temperature that they're using. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. So I've actually been using a CO2 nitrogen, a so-called stout mix with my mead and wine in it. It's turned out fine because most of it I keep at room temperature, and turns out the mix is just about right for room temperature.
That was going to be my next question, is what temperature, because you're totally right. If you're serving high 60s, low 70s, somewhere in that range, then yeah, I agree with you. I think beer gas mix of any sort is probably just fine.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. So that's sort of the cheap option. And then, like you said, if you want to go fancy, you can go argon, or I've even seen some more recent systems that they're starting to put out where they actually have a... what they do is they put a bag, like a Mylar bag, inside the keg that holds the wine. What they're doing is they're isolating the gas from the wine, right?
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, but I mean, that's not typically something you can do with a homebrew system, at least not yet.
We'll work on that.
Yeah, you need to get some Mylar bags that fit inside the
we've already played with this, so it's nothing new, but we haven't found an affordable sanitary version yet.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. So there are some options there, though, and it is kind of neat to serve wine off the keg.
I agree. And you're going to see it. It's already starting here in California. I don't know about the rest of the country, but it's almost considered a little, I don't want to say elite, but it's becoming prestigious now to see certain wines on tap.
Nice. Well, do you have any additional tips for those looking to dive into kegging their homebrew?
Go slow. It's easier than you think. we have lots of material on our website, and I know Beersmith as well, about kegging, PDFs you can download, parts list.
Of course, our last podcast, too.
I was going to say, our last podcast, if you're just getting into kegging, I would start there, because I think we've really broke down all the things, lots of pictures.
Yeah, watch the YouTube version, because we did have a lot of images for that one.
Yeah, so I think that's probably your best place to start. But, you know, don't be intimidated by it. It's a lot easier than you would think. Set the CO2 regulator at 12 PSI and you probably can't fail. Never mix up your quick disconnects, and you're pretty much good to go.
Yeah, I always put little tape on mine so I know which one's which.
That is smart. You know, more people should do that on their lines itself. You know, like either a one and a two, or one for your which faucet it's going to come out of. I typically forget to do that, and then I'm just playing a big guess.
I do the same thing with like car batteries, so I don't mix up the positive and negative. You know, blow myself up. I'm a marine battery.
That's a smart move.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And again, my guest today was Mr. Chris Graham. Chris is the president of More Beer and a former AHA and BA board member. Chris, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks again.
A big thank you to Chris Graham for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines backsparge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the wart clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system I personally brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And I recently converted the Beersmith recipe site to support mobile devices and also added the majority of the Beersmith brewing and unit conversion tools. Subscribers to Beersmith 3 can access over 17 brewing tools online from any device, and anyone with an account can browse tens of thousands of recipes. Visit beersmithrecipes.com for your phone or computer to set up your free account today. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.